day and welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. First, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market reminds you that every bite has a story, so whether it's a tomato, a muffin, or a T-bone steak, your conscious food choices can change the planet. Because at Whole Foods Market, every single purchase you make helps us support things like animal welfare, organic agriculture, equitable trade, and energy offsets. Let's think before we eat. Let's retake our plates. On today's show, I have a couple people. John Koenig, photographer. Allison Attenborough, food stylist, but there's so much more to you than just that. And Ryan Rice, her partner in crime, assistant, all around good guy. Thank you all for being on the air.
Thank you.
We're just going to kind of dive into all these different facets of food photography styling, maybe spin off a little bit in fracking as well, as we were discussing prior to the show. I just really wanted to start with background. Allison will always be a chef, food stylist, restaurant consultant, recipe developer, author, winner of cookbook awards. Your background in education was in cooking originally rather than styling.
I went to college when I left school. My parents insisted that I went to college, and I was originally going to go to art college. So I always had a keen interest in arts, and I was very interested in fashion. And at one point, I thought I was going to be a fashion designer.
Yeah.
But then I had the fight with the art teacher in the last year of school. And my
parents... What was that fight about?
I don't remember. I mean, I was sort of rebellious at that age, and I rebelled. And then my parents wanted me to do an artistic sort of career. And so I decided to really rebel and say I'd work in a bank, which would be totally awful. But I did that. And then they said, no, you're not doing that. You're going to college. And we found out about this home economics course, and we think that would be great for you. And I think they thought that once I did the home economics course, I was going to go and cook for these bankers in the bank.
Yeah.
And then I'd marry the banker, and I'd be sort of sorted out.
Yeah.
But I wasn't really that person at that point. Anyway.
You are now.
No.
And John as well, your background was in photography, but not necessarily in food, though. You had just divulged to me that, you know, at a young age, you traveled around France, eating your way all the way down to Morocco.
Yeah, no, I think it fell into food photography, really. I think from shooting a lot of travel stories... I think Frederica, who's at Food and Wine, saw something I shot in Travel and Leisure, and that's led to me shooting food for them, and then everything else kind of followed from that, really.
I think. But did you have a devout interest in food prior to?
I've always enjoyed eating, but I had a lot of food related jobs as a student. I worked as a in a pizza shop, making pizzas. And I was a cook in a restaurant for 2 or 3 years as a student. So, but I've never been interested in creating recipes or anything like that.
But I think being a stylist and working with a photographer that really loves food and likes to eat makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
And that actually is what makes John a great food photographer. It's because when people love to eat and they see food in that way and understand it, that visually comes through,
yeah.
I think.
It's an interested perspective. Mm-hmm. Plus, it's not only engaging, but you want to almost shoot faster so you can eat it sometimes, too.
Yeah.
And Ryan, you've been in restaurants forever.
Yeah, since I was 14, my first job was in a restaurant. I sort of fell into it. It's like what you did in St. Augustine. You either worked in a restaurant or you probably didn't work. I don't know. Seemed like we all did.
And you've cooked in a couple of restaurants in New York?
Yeah, I worked at the River Cafe and a couple other ones around town. Went out to California, worked at Luke Restaurant for Suzanne Goen.
One of the coolest cookbooks in the last 5 years.
Yeah, she's an amazing person.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a real pleasure to work for her.
Excellent. I actually just made a whole bunch of the Guinness stout cakes. Well, a riff on them. Friends over at Six Point Brewery do a big anniversary party every year, and my girlfriend, I taste test more than I bake, made about 200 of their beer style cupcakes.
That's a lot of cupcakes.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the frosting on that cupcake?
Just regular, butter, confectioner sugar, milk. That's it. Straight, simple forwards. But it's orange because their
branded logo is orange.
Oh, cool.
Simple, but fantastic cookbook. We use that as a base recipe, and her Romesco sauce is kind of like a staple in my back pocket.
Yeah, I love that stuff.
So you all have this interest in food, but not necessarily this professional direction towards it. What was the turning point for all of you?
As far as going to food specifically,
yeah, you said it was travel, but was there a specific travel story or food story that, you know, made you say, I want to do more of this?
For me,
yeah,
when I was at college doing the home economics, I had to do lots of other things. Like, I was really interested in the nutritional side of things, and I was interested in the cooking side of things. And then I learned a lot of about baking, because you're studying the components and what makes the thing rise and what each of those ingredients do. So I got very interested in that. But because I was very rebellious, and I was this girl that just liked to dress up and go to nightclubs and was pretty interested in boys above all, the good thing was that I was chosen, or they offered to me, do you want to go and be an intern for Time Life Books in the photo studio? And I was 17, 18, and I really didn't realize the actual significance of that until maybe a few years ago, because I was working on the books called The Time Life Good Cook with Richard Olney, with Jeremiah Towers. I mean, Elizabeth David would come to lunch. Yeah. Jane Grigson would come to lunch.
And if people don't know these names, you know, research them now, because this is the foundation for a lot of modern American cooking.
And Richard Olney was, I mean, such a force and changed actually the eating habits of a lot of people in America. So, I mean, I was so young, I didn't really understand that at the time, but I was so fortunate to be around those people at that time. And so I think that really changed my perspective of food, and I learned so much. And those people are a lot older than me, and they really took me in, and they, you know, really showed me some different things. So for me, that was probably my turning point, and really where I became really interested in food, and it really took a turn for
me. So it was more seeing that there was something past just the aesthetic, that there was a culture and people that could live within that culture and perpetuate, you know, an ideal.
So
it wasn't just like seeing, oh, that's the best looking cake I've ever seen. It was hearing these stories.
And I was working, you know, I would have to find the ingredients. And at that point in England, it pretty much was like boiled to death vegetables and overcooked meat. And they were bringing this whole new thing even to England. And I would have to go and find carrots with tops on, which sounds like crazy. But I would have to get up at 4 a.m. and go to Nine Elms, this market, to get a carrot with a top on, because you couldn't find that.
Yeah.
And you would have to get the lobsters shipped from France. They didn't have lobsters. We didn't have this whole system of food then. It literally was probably just what's local, but everything's already pre-trimmed. And it, I mean, to food style then was really different.
Yeah. And it sounds like eating habits were different too. Like, what kind of food did you grow up with, John?
A lot of frozen food. I hope my mom's listening.
I hope she is. I need a listener. My mom listens. My girlfriend's mom's listen. Big on moms with this show. So
I always tease her. I say, if it's not frozen, it ain't food.
Yeah. See, we begged to have frozen food because it was so kind of cool and new, I think, in a way.
Yeah. Oh, we did too, actually. You still have that baked Alaska. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing wrong with baked Alaska. I love baked
Not
Alaska.
Baked Alaska. I think
no, Arctic Roll. Because in Nigel Slater's book, he mentions Arctic Roll. And it's weird, but he says, like, growing up, ours was the kind of family that had Arctic Roll.
Yeah, exactly.
And Arctic Roll was like this frozen ice cream that came in like a sort of roll, like a Swiss roll, with like chocolate grated on the top
of it.
So
it's like Boucher Noël, but
it was like more of an everyday thing, but it was probably quite expensive. So it's sort of like a special occasion to have that.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, to have the household that had the Arctic roll, you were kind of like a little bit special.
Yeah.
It's sort of funny in suburban England.
Ryan, did you grow up in suburban England, and did you grow up with Arctic roll?
Nah, I never heard of it. I grew up in St. Augustine, Florida, a little beach town. And my, it's kind of crazy how I got into food. Sort of works because my dad's an artist, and the whole idea of working with your hands for a profession was just kind of felt right for me. My family had on my mom's side, my grandfather had an Italian restaurant. So when I was growing up, I loved going in there and eating. And like John, one of my favorite things to do is to eat.
Yeah.
So I had a crazy idea when I was 16. I wanted to be an environmentalist, you know, and I had no idea what I would do. So I tried to go to college, and I was no good at it, you know, with the science and math. And I just realized that possibly I could do both. I could cook and be an environmentalist, and that's how I ended up where I am today, you know. And we might be just doing, you know, food styling, you might not realize, but the ingredients that we source are all from the farmer's market, and we're totally dedicated to where they come from, and everything behind what you see in the magazine is we try every day, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I don't think a lot of people understand the morality and ethos and ethics of the people behind the picture. There's a lot of coverage and, you know, imagery of the farmers and farm to table and, you know, the chefs using this wonderful produce, but it's also all the people that help develop and test, and, you know, there's an inherent goodness that they want to project on the page, and you all subscribe to that. Mm-hmm. There are rules that Allison has, or so she was telling me. If you'd like to recite a couple, and these aren't like
rules
to live by. Yeah, go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, I'll let Ryan. He knows some of those things.
One of our biggest rules is no plastic bags. Like, if we go out shopping for ingredients, we bring our own bags. And we kind of get mad at other people that use them. It just seems so wasteful. And I don't know if you've ever been to the beach and seen a plastic bag wash up.
And that's how I actually found out about it. That's what made me more militant about the plastic bag and the carrying your recycled bag or your cloth bag. Was that there's a woman we work with at New York Magazine, Gillian Duffy, and she's a big foodie, and so we learnt it from a foodie. But she sails every summer, and she said in Europe now, whenever you're sailing, like literally the plastic bags are coming off from the landfill, you know, from below or whatever, and they're floating all around. And she said, you get plastic wherever you sail now.
Yeah.
And she said, you cannot use a plastic bag. So she made me more militant.
It's like that same visualization of, you know, cutting up the six-pack containers, you know,
because
there were those pictures of seals and fish getting stuck in them in, like,
the 80s and 90s.
And,
early 90s.
And Ryan actually has his own thing that he's very militant about, which is to never drink out of the plastic bottle of water.
Oh,
and
I hate
he
that.
Always drinks the tap water.
Such a scam.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the biggest scam in the world right now. You know, getting a Fiji water from the other side of the planet in the thickest plastic bottle possible, and it's really just rainwater. Right here in New York, we have amazing water right out of the tap.
Yeah, I don't know if I should admit this, but I drink out of the tap, like, directly, like it's a little, you know, fountain at
just
the school sometimes.
Oh,
yeah. I show my cat how it's done. Yeah definitely.
John carries his bottle as well, his own private bottle.
Yeah,
been trying to actually from working with Andrew Rusing. She's really big on, you know, she doesn't use any bottled water in the restaurant, and she has a way of, you know, putting gas into the water. What do you call that?
Carbonator.
And this is Andrea Rusing
from Lantern in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Which John's working on this book, and I actually
it's actually finished already.
Oh, yeah. I met John at kind of a little soiree she had in New York introducing the book, which comes out this spring.
Yeah.
Correct? And Andrea's food, the book's called Cooking in the Moment, correct? And you can feel the kind of not just whimsical, but light and very, you know, ephemeral approach to her food and her touch. And
I guess I wasn't trying to plug the book.
Yeah. But no, you don't have to. Once people see this, it will plug itself.
Exactly. I mean, there you go.
Yeah.
But no, working with her, you know, I was one of those people that would just stop at the gas station and buy a big liter bottle of Evian. <Evian's laughs> And then he traveled 2,000 miles. But working with her, I started feeling guilty. So yeah, that's when the water container came out, the metal, you know, can. It's just as easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's funny to see you saying traveling around, stopping at gas stations, that there is this correlation between travel and food, like going from wanting to explore more than just your local system and seeing that there are different systems that operate in a similar fashion and trying to replicate that wherever you go, keeping it sustainable, keeping it real,
right,
et cetera. So, it perpetuates. We're going to take a quick break and then come on back, talk a little bit about the environmental aspects of food styling and photography. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.com. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here with food photographer John Koenig, food stylist Allison Attenborough, and all-around good guy, as I said before, Ryan Rice. We were kind of talking about, you know, first their backgrounds and influences and traveling and getting into food, but then kind of ended on this environmental note that I think we should explore a little bit more. It wasn't necessarily a question I had, you know, prior to having you in the studio, but right before we entered, fracking was brought up. A lot of people, I don't think, know what it is, and if anyone would like to expand on that idea.
I just found out about it because I went to see a movie called Gasland, which a friend sent me to at NYU, and it's about fracking, which is basically drilling for natural gas, which is going to be pitched as this sort of alternative energy idea. But the thing about it is, once you watch this movie, which is now actually up for an Oscar, it's actually the impact of this fracking is that it destroys the water supply.
It's not just drilling though, is it? It's drilling down into shale and slate and smashing.
Smashing right through the earth's sort of surface, way, way down. And so you don't only get the impact of that; you're going to get the impact of it. Requires a ton, like loads and loads of water, just to work. You know, to cool it down or whatever it has to do, but the impact it has on these poor people who live around it. They come into the small towns, and predominantly in Texas, in Colorado, they've been doing it for more than 10 years, and then you see the results of it, which are that these poor people, their water supply is completely destroyed. There's, you know, I think it's more than 500 chemicals have to go down into the earth, and within. And we're in the gas to, you know, to get it to go to work. But I think these poor people, their whole water supply is destroyed, and you see them actually light their faucets on fire.
Oof.
And then the water in the surrounding areas, the streams and stuff, they obviously don't have to follow a lot of guidelines, the safety guidelines, which you also need to look into, but you need to see the movie because it's quite complicated.
Yeah.
But basically what I gained from seeing this movie is that this is about to happen upstate in New York, which will affect all of us, because we have this incredible infrastructure that our water comes from the Catskills. It was created 100 years ago, and it's the most efficient, most clean water in the whole of America. And if they do the fracking up there, which Pennsylvania has 100% approved, but New York hasn't, because people in New York have actually thought about this, but then all of this water supply will change. We won't have this beautiful clean water. And in terms of the food and our food supply, obviously what's going to happen is it's going to alter the whole farming.
And maybe forced to buy bottled water, you know, because there is no...
That's a good point.
You know, necessary alternative. But, I mean, recipe-wise, I want to talk about food for a sec. Baking, can that exist without water? I mean, stocks, soups, sodas, drinks. I mean...
No, water's in... I mean, our body is made up of water,
isn't it? Yeah,
it's
kind of elemental.
It's in everything. Yeah. It's the elemental starting point. And they say that the next crisis will be water rather than oil, actually. It's going to be the next crisis for us all.
But so, see the movie Gasland, read up about fracking, and back to food. That was your little PSA. I want to talk a little more about some of the cookbooks you've worked on, John. Salt to Taste with Marco Canora, and A Great American Cook with Jonathan Waxman, who are two fantastic New York chefs, and, you know, fountainheads of what they do. How did those books differ, and how did those books even evolve?
I think the Marco Canora book evolved from working with him on a food and wine project in Italy. He had a little cooking school that he did with his... Allison's saying something inside here.
No, awesome.
He had a cooking school with his mother in Italy. So we went there and photographed that. And then he had the book project and asked if I'd photograph it for him.
Yeah. I remember that spread. It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, so that was, you know, he had a lot of strong ideas too about things that he liked, inspiration that he had. It was a good project.
Yeah,
he's very, very enthusiastic too.
Yeah,
fantastic.
He's really a bulldog, but with. You know, definitely in the right vein.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And Jonathan Waxman, similar story. We did a story for Gourmet Magazine, and then the, you know, shooting his book sort of evolved from that.
So do you see a lot of projects spiral from you know, magazine assignments into books? Or were these your first two?
No, and then Andrea Riesling too. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
The story with her, and then the book project came after that. So no, I think it's an obvious progression. If you know, as a chef, if you worked with a photographer and you like the results, you know, to then hire them to do a book.
Yeah.
Does it make sense?
Oh yeah. I mean, Allison, do you find a lot of your work kind of flows that way too? Because I want to go back to the book that you authored with Jamie Kim, The Cooking for Friends with William Sonoma. Priorly, you had done a ton of William Sonoma's books.
I'd worked on a lot of their books, and they kind of knew that I had a sense not just about the food, but that was also had a sense about style and had very specific ideas about that. So I think they thought it would be a great idea to sort of team up someone who had a strong visual sense as well as the food sense and try to do something a little bit different for them.
Yeah.
And they came with the little guidelines, and they wanted to do things four ways, which actually I think they sort of got the idea from Food and Wine, because Food and Wine used to do these recipes where they tried the same recipe and they would alter it and do it for the four ways. So yeah, they came to me, and that was a really fun, it's really fun to work on your own project with your own vision. You know, that did have perimeters, because William Sonoma is a very specific customer. And I think if it were me, it would have been a little bit like looser and have a little bit more of my personality within that. But it definitely was a great experience. And I got to develop a lot of recipes, put in a lot of my own personal style, and it was really fun to work on.
Yeah. Speaking of your kind of own vision of things, you've worked a lot with Food & Wine magazine.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you get to impart your own vision in those stories?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, it was fun. John and I did one once, which was a color story, and then we were able to kind of alter recipes a little bit and come up with more visual ideas. And I like doing that kind
of
thing.
What was the color story?
That was... Was that the wine one, John?
Two years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember if it was the wine one. I think it was
the
colour.
You did a nice one with Con too.
Yeah, I did another one with Con. We did one. One was a wine pairing from white. I think that was one with Con, white to red.
Yeah.
And then they worked and developed these recipes that went with the different wines, but then where they were in this sort of situation of the colour, you know, background.
Yeah.
And then the one with John was literally about the colour of the food.
Yeah.
So it was having fun having challenges like eggplant and doing it on purple, and eggplant's quite hard to shoot. And there were some fun things, and then I came up with the purple basil, so you get that colour in. So that was a fun project. And
so how often do you collaborate with the other creative, like the stylist and the photographer, you know, talk prior to the magazine approaching them for the
job? Think when Food & Wine have a big well story like that, we all met and we came up with our own ideas and we all collaborated. And I think, I mean, Food & Wine for me has been a great magazine to work on, because you're dealing with very good, high quality food and recipes from really interesting people and very smart chefs, and they've got their team of testers at Food & Wine. So there's that's been a really great experience. And they're doing this thing right now, this wine show, which they're involved with. And for me, I'm doing a totally different thing where I get more involved with dealing with the chefs directly and sort of getting them to do the food on the show. And that's been a really different challenge for me.
I've always wondered how that differed, and this is a two-part question, because how does, you know, 2D translate into television? And John, have you ever shot video?
It's becoming more. I've done a few video projects for Food & Wine for the iPad, and also for Martha Stewart. We did a community garden story last year, which is coming out in the summer, I think, where we interviewed a bunch of people who have this community garden in Philadelphia. So there's a lot of on-camera interviewing and, you know, different stuff like that for the iPad. But not for TV, I don't think.
Yeah, and how has TV kind of affected your aesthetic? How has, you know, motion come
Well, I'd worked on a lot of film, actually, when I lived in L.A. So I worked on the Titanic. I worked on this movie called Wild Wild West. And I'd done, actually, a little bit of costume on a film called The Crossing Guard. But I actually... I didn't really enjoy the process so much of film in a way, because the schedule changes a lot, and the food has to be you know, it's quite static a lot of the time, and you're doing hundreds of takes. Like on the Titanic, sometimes you did 60 takes.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit like why I didn't really like catering, because you're constantly redoing the same thing. And for me, I'm actually like to move on and do things quite fast and have a bit of a slow sort of attention span in a certain way.
Yeah.
And the thing about TV, it's very instant. Again, you might have to do lots of takes. But what's interesting about this wine show is I'm actually more of a prop stylist, and then I help the chef like maybe come up with what can be finger food that goes in the set. So it's a little bit more of being like a sort of almost like a PR person, or sort of networking with people and being more chatty, which is a bit fun when you're normally in the kitchen with, you know, your assistant. Like with Ryan and I, we're just together on our own in the kitchen, and some jobs we're collaborating with the photographer and with the stylist, and some we're really literally just cooking.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of nice to have this social aspect of meeting people and doing that within the job. So it's a nice balance.
So you're just saying you're tired of just hanging out with Ryan all the time?
No. How could I ever?
Client-wise, too, you do a lot of editorial, but you also do ad. How do those clients differ? And who have you been working with lately?
I've been working... we've been doing, should I say the ad client?
Is that, Oh, yeah.
We've been actually working on a project which was to, with Lean Cuisine, to actually try to loosen their product, make it more appealing, because they're finding that there's, it's very staid advertising in America for food, a lot of it. So they're trying to make it a little bit more sort of young and youthful and a little bit more approachable, I think, and trying to get those customers. And I think that this whole like local and the organic movement and the look of more organic things is filtering into advertising.
Yeah.
So they have to be aware about that. So that was one of the projects. My favorite thing I work on is probably doing drinks and Grey Goose, and that's my passion to do those, because it's like, it's more, it's quite challenging when you're working with the real eyes, and doing the TV for that is really challenging.
What's the challenge? I mean,
well, the challenge when you're doing the TV particularly is you've got this camera, and it's costing a lot of money to do those commercials, and they want it all real Grey Goose, so you've got this ice like melting, and you're running around trying to you know, get the right looking cube, and whether it's completely clear or whether it's got texture to that cube, and there's lots of tricks within that, and spraying the glasses, and we actually did do Coca-Cola in Florida, and it's funny because they wanted this food within that ad, but they're not used to doing food, so they almost sort of forgot the food, and it's sort of left till the end, and like it's just sort of interesting.
Yeah,
I think it's one thing that people don't realize when they watch movies and TV shows, that, you know, there's someone behind all the food that you see there. Someone's had to create that. I think, I mean, even I, until recently, didn't really occur to me that someone actually did all that stuff. I think when Susan did which is a big food one, but
but I also find it fascinating that liquid is almost that much harder subject to deal with, both, you know, styling and photography too sometimes.
Like keeping it real too, so it looks, you know. I went to someone once who sprayed the outside of a glass with some sort of oil to make it look like it was had condensation
on
the glass.
It's glycerin and water.
But then it was above the line of the liquid, so it looked bizarre. So then he's trying to wipe it off with the, you know. And then the ice cube was strange. I said, well, it was a fake ice cube. So how about redoing this?
The one with the fly in it.
He's a real ice cube.
No, you see, we're like the natural crowd that like it all like quite sort of natural, so it's quite funny.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have these challenges where you're doing it all in, because it has to sit there in the sort of like bright light. Or
hot lights,
Plus, if you've got a Grey Goose, you want to be able to drink it afterwards.
Yeah.
That's usually my job.
Yeah.
Not a bad gig to have. Hot lights. I keep on hearing this. How often are hot lights used on sets versus, you know, strobes and stuff?
What is a hot light?
Hot light is like a tungsten incandescent, so it actually emits a little bit of heat. Do you work with lights that do that, or do you work with strobes that don't?
Well, John would know. John doesn't use lights, but you sometimes have to for advertising, though.
I mean, if I very rarely I use strobe over hot lights, just because it's easier to balance it with daylight.
Yeah.
I mean, 9 times out of 10, I'll just use daylight.
Yeah,
we sometimes do work with lights. I mean, we work with
and with TV you have to use hot lights, don't you?
Yeah, with TV it's all hot lights. And then I feel like if there's a lot of like still life photographers we work with that do more like product and fashion,
yeah,
and we work with some amazing people that do that, And for example, we were doing a DoubleTree ad with a photographer called Alain Rubin, and he's using lights, and I think those would be considered hot lights.
Yeah.
And strobe, I guess, right? Would they, John? I think so, right? I mean, they're set lights, so yeah. They are, yeah. And yeah. So that's different. I mean, with cookies, it's easy. It's not a problem. Sometimes when you're doing like salads and things like that, they're obviously going to wilt faster.
Yeah.
So you've got to have everything ready to switch out, and it's in ice baths and stuff.
Because how real is food styling? I mean, I've asked this question to a couple other stylists before, and people outside of the industry think that you're just putting a whole bunch of fake stuff on a plate.
No, I think actually this is a misconception. I think in the 80s when I started assisting... and working, say, for when I did The Good Cook, that was all done for real. And I think, but advertising and things in 10 years ago, and when I first started assisting in America and worked on Bon Appetit magazine, everything was lit. And everything had to sit there for a long time. And all the advertising was definitely, definitely faked. But I think there's two things that happened, and John would know more about this. But the format of photography, because they could shoot on a smaller camera and they didn't need to use lights and they could shoot much faster, then the food became much more about being real. And all our food and wine shoots, we eat that food. All of it. And most editorial shoots that we do now, we eat all the food and we buy good quality ingredients, so it's not wasted. So we do eat it and we share it out and take it home, and everything is 100% edible.
Yeah. Even before I brought up that I feel like I myself am a sustainable food photographer because I subscribe to that, Ryan had said, well, we're sustainable food stylists. So.
But not everybody is, I have to say. So, that is something that we care about and are into.
Yeah.
So obviously that somehow filters down into our work.
Yeah, and it shows in the aesthetic too by the quality of ingredients and, also it's limiting in its factor of how much you buy. So sometimes it's that whimsical, chaos theory of, well, all we have are these basil bushes and all we have are, these ingredients to work with, and we have to do our best with that. And that's, that same mentality almost of, working with what you have rather than extending to something that's unnatural.
Right. I think it definitely transcends the way it looks. If you're using horrible ingredients, you feel horrible when you're working with them, and then it may not look as beautiful as, if you have the fresh farmer's market arugula from your favorite farmer and everybody's smiling and having a good time.
Yeah. The feeling exudes. It shows itself on the page.
And sometimes when you are working on advertising, I mean, it is difficult because it's not necessarily what you believe in.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to be 100% there for that sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think, John? You just don't worry about that.
I try not to worry about it.
The money, right?
Oh, yeah.
Shall I get too ethical about it?
Yeah.
But, I mean, the majority of the projects you work on, and like you were saying before, how Andrea Rusing really changed your, concept of even water itself. Allison made a very valid point that one person can make a difference.
No, it's true. That's all it takes.
Yeah, and because people say to you, what's the point of you doing that? What's the point? It's just you. What good is that going to do in the big picture? But if everyone thinks like that, it had an influence on John, like Ryan had an influence on me with my plastic bottles, because even though I'm carrying my cloth bag, I'm still drinking plastic bottles of water. And we all have our little things that we're into and focus on.
Yeah, but one person at a time, one step at a time, towards a better planet and
guilt-free planet.
Greater food for all. Thank you all for being on the show. This was jam-packed, informative. We're going to have a fracking show because of this. I promise you that.
Right.
Thanks.
John Koenig, Allison Attenborough, Ryan Rice. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Thanks to our sponsor, Whole Food, executive producer Jack Inslee. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turco. Ciao.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. The Snacky Tunes compilation has arrived and is available for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com. This compilation features live performances from some of the hottest acts around today, including Midnight Magic, Surfer Blood, Oberhofer, and more. Again, you can download this compilation for free on our website, heritageradionetwork.com, and make sure to listen to Snacky Tunes every Monday at 2 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network.